Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. David Roach is betting big on carbs, grit, and love. After a near-fatal bike crash in April 2024, ultra-runner David Roach decided to go all in chasing big goals. 5 months later, he shattered the Leadville Trail 100 record and now has his sights set on winning Western States. This is by David Kelly. In April 2024, David Roach's body was on a beeline towards death. Thrown off his bike by a turning car, Roach flew 100 feet into a fence. A concussion, a broken wrist, and stitches ensued. But so too did the lingering effects of a near-death experience. A strange and wildly scary reminder of fragility that feels all the more terrifying when one is blessed with a body that has never had to be reminded of such a thing. For Roach, that accident was what led to his fuck it moment. A decision to live his life as a demonstration of love, grit, and joy. While recovering, Roach decided that he needed to go big. Fuck the haters, climb the mountains, do the thing. And he did. He won the historic Leadville Trail 100 just 5 months later. It was the first attempt at the distance. He set a course record. When I first spoke to David Roach in February 2025, it only took him about 30 seconds to mention death. Everything, Roach told me over the phone, starts with death and impermanence. It was a jarring introduction for someone whose public persona feels so overwhelmingly positive. Love, kindness, awesomeness, even huzzah. These words punctuate Roach's militant social media posts, his Strava runs, and recently the texts and emails he sent my way. So excited, he mailed me with 4 exclamation marks, then I told him I was flying out to Boulder, Colorado, to spend some time with him. And yet, as he told me over the phone, he's always subject to entropy, the unaltered process by which each of us, and I do mean each of us, is heading on that beeline toward death. Though Roach was quick upon introduction to remind me of death, the first time I met him in person, I found myself face to face with the explosion of life itself. He opened the door to his house just outside of Boulder, and his dog, Addie, a golden retriever, Australian shepherd, and a pug mix, shot out of the gap and sprinted my way. Inside, as Addie twirled a series of endless figure eights around my legs, I looked upon a living room full of playful disorder. Roach's youngest child, Ollie, just a few months old, sat placidly amidst a carpet littered with toy cars and blocks. His oldest, the 2-year-old Leo, whose name stands for Love Each Other, spent the evening collecting and then hurling those same toy cars off precipices, couch cushions, tables, even his father's back. All the while, David and his wife, Megan, an accomplished runner, podcast host, and dual doctorate holder in medicine epidemiology, toggled between talking with me and playing with and feeding both kids. Play, David told me, is the ultimate set of love. Roche, 36 years old, is currently one of the most accomplished ultramarathoners of the moment. His win and course record at Leadville serving as a stepping stone for him to be ranked by Ultra Running Magazine as the number 2 ultra runner of 2024. This year, Roche's life centered around 3 people, Megan, Leo, and Ollie, and one very public goal, win the Western States 100 Mile, one of ultra running's most coveted achievements. Western States is held on the final weekend of June, and it begins on the floor of the Olympic Valley in California, climbing and descending through the Sierra Nevada as it makes its way to Auburn, California. There's often snow, there's always rugged desert heat. There is a river crossing. It's like that classic game, Oregon Trail, where players don't know what will happen or in what specific way they will suffer, only that they will. Jim Walmsley, the current course record holder, famously took a wrong turn in 2016 and then pulled out of the race in 2017 before winning in 2018 and setting the course record in 2019. In other words, the course is not forgiving, especially if you are reaching for greatness, and David Roach is reaching for greatness. He has, to put it playfully, called his shot, the way someone does when they are 6 years old and playing baseball in the backyard. Shoot or shoot, one of his Instagram captions read. Roach doesn't just want to win Western States and set a course record. He also wants to do it the way he wants to, with his own mix of self-experimentation and science. It is a recipe that calls for some David Roach obsessions: carbs, bicarbs, hill sprints, cycling, heat suits, and more. Roach trains outside of Boulder in this MacGyver-style, high-octane, pedal-to-the-metal way, using a mix of running and cycling, along with variation of speed work, intervals, and high-intensity carb consumption. It's a recipe born from over a decade spent coaching his SWAP, Some Work, All Play, athletes alongside his wife. That endeavor, which began in 2014, has grown into an elite program with both David and Megan coaching A-list athletes such as Claire Gallagher, Grayson Murphy, Ali Ostrander, and more. Roche's running and coaching are informed by studying, reading, and experimenting with the results of studies from various endurance-focused laboratories and sports. Roach calls a professional cycling peloton the greatest uncontrolled experiment in human physiology, but Roach himself might be the real owner of that title. One of his athletes, Ryan Sullivan, who placed not far behind Roach at Leadville and just recently finished 5th at the Chuckanut 50K, labeled Roach a genius. The amount of information he can take in, interpret, and act upon is still remarkable to me, no matter how accustomed to it I get, said Sullivan. He'll remember stuff like a taper method we tried like 11 races ago and why it might not apply to an upcoming one. For Roach, a normal week of training will consist of a few easy long runs of 15 to 16 miles, sometimes end with hill sprints or an inclined treadmill run. will also contain one or two long bike rides, either outside or on Zwift, a virtual reality cycling world connected to an indoor bike setup where each cyclist's data, including cadence, heart rate, and power, controls an in-game virtual cyclist. There are various courses and worlds, and many indoor trainers can, through resistance changes, mimic the hills and mountains that exist in these worlds. Roche prefers going up and down Zwift's famed Alpe d'Huez, modeled after infamous Alpe d'Huez with its 21 hairpin turns and its 3,670 feet elevation gain. And then there will be the big days, 20 miles. 20 miles at sub-6-minute pace, mile repeats at 4:30 pace. All in Roche's running mileage hovers between 55 and 80 miles per week, considerably less than many competitive ultra-runners who, by Roche estimates, are running at least 100 miles a week, with some peaking closer to 120 or higher. But Roche training isn't just about running. Each of Roche's workouts also contains another workout, a workout of the gut. When I met him one day for an easy run that followed 20 miles at a pace a shade under 6 minutes, I first watched him guzzle about 40 ounces of fluid in under 2 minutes. Roche was training his stomach to handle the rapid intake of fluids and carbohydrates in order to help lessen the kind of setbacks that might happen mid-race if he were to attempt to fuel at the rate he aims to. In a race, Roche targets between 120 and 150 grams of carbs per hour. To put that in perspective, consider that each packet of Martin's best-selling gel 100 contains 25 grams of carbs. Most recreational runners might consume one or two packets of this gel per hour. Roche would consume up to 6 per hour for many hours. This aspect of Roche's training is one of the pillars of success. Roche is adamant that we are living in a carb revolution. Quoted, high carb allows athletes to push harder during races without burning through their fuel stores. For example, previous Leadville record holder Matt Carpenter is better than me on all fitness metrics like VO2 max and lactate threshold. But high carb intake allows me to push harder relative to my lower fitness levels. But the biggest change is that higher carb intake improves adaptation and recovery. Every day in training, we're playing a high stakes game with our health and stress levels. High carb tilts the table in our favor. I am 36 going on 22. That's because carbs let me push harder on the day and then adapt faster than ever before. End quote. For Roche, this approach to fueling is the most emphatic performance revolution we'll ever see in all of endurance sports, he said. Any record that has lasted more than 3 years is going down. As I've been writing this piece, records have fallen left and right. Grant Fisher broke the indoor 5,000-meter record not long after breaking the 3,000-meter record. Seth Ruling and Riley Brady broke course records at the prestigious Black Canyon 100K. The first day I spoke on the phone with Roche, the world record for the mile had just been broken for the second time in 1 week. The science on carbs, though, is still out. A 2013 study on the relationship between carbs and endurance made the case that carbs are better at the outset of a workout, but that continued higher doses may hurt performance. For outside, Alex Hutchinson summed up this data as follows. The sweet spot where performance is optimized in this data is the 78 grams of carbohydrate per hour, consistent with the idea that 60 to 90 grams is the right range. Hutchinson followed that up with context about a 2018 study that showed some evidence that 90 grams of carbs per hour is the best option for endurance athletes. If either of these studies is the case, then Roche is essentially doubling that sweet spot of performance when he is racing, pushing his carb intake to the far reaches that place beyond scientific study. And he's not just doing this for 1 hour, he's doing it for 14. The best comparison for this is not found in running, it's actually found in cycling, where Roche draws a great deal of his inspiration. As it's becoming clear, the carbohydrate revolution that Roche is championing has become commonplace in the professional peloton. For Velo, Jim Cotton writes, quote, from the front to the back of the peloton, riders are now crushing 100 to 120 grams of carbohydrates per hour. That's almost twice what they might have managed a decade ago. It's a carb equivalent of a 12-ounce can of cola every 20 minutes or more. 20 minutes, or more than 2 cups of cooked white rice per hour. And so if you're reading this, think you are fueling enough for your workouts? David Roche would tell you that you're probably not. Roche fuels with what I can only correctly call a perverse insanity. When I watch him guzzle almost 48 ounces of high-carb drink mix immediately after a 20-mile run, I could feel my own stomach blowing up. I'll stand there in his kitchen watching a shirtless man with taped nickels chug powdered drip drink mix the way I once saw college friends drink from a keg of beer. There was a part of me that felt almost scared. I think I trembled a little bit. I also think I saw God. As I jogged a few miles with him afterward, I thought about all that drink mix sloshing around in his gut, but his stomach bouncing with each step. He told me it was a secret, that the gains will be massive for anyone who buys into what's happening now with carbs and fueling, as brands like Martin and Precision Fuel churn out gels loaded with 30, 60, and 90 grams of carbs. And then, as if to prove it, he absolutely dusted me on a series of hill sprints. I had run 4 miles prior to these sprints. He had run 24. There is an unspoken third aspect of training that takes root as you spend time with Roche, and that has something to do with the mind. For someone so obsessed with the granular details of carbohydrates and fueling, Roche runs with an easy, excitable freedom. I get the sense while chasing after Roche that I was with someone who had taken the training wheels off his life. He's going to careen down the mountainside, body trembling, maybe afraid, but also shouting with joy. lot of my development over time, he told me, has been deprogramming. Deprogramming his own negative attitude about himself. Deprogramming his own conceptions about the body. Deprogramming his own idea about how to show up in the world. This humility has created an interesting, to say the least, person who somehow, someone who exudes seemingly boundless joy even after guzzling nearly a gallon of liquid. Someone who throws down the gauntlet for one of the most prestigious ultramarathons in the world, while also, at the same time, acknowledging that if there's snow on that first mountain climb at Western States, he might be a little bit fucked. How do you get that kind of person? I don't know. Roach told me that his journey was never going to be a linear path, and he's certainly not a linear man. Roach's athletic career began with a sport diametrically opposed to running, football. Indeed, at a 2018 induction ceremony at the Queen Anne's County High School Sports Hall of Fame, Roach joked, "I kind of look like an equipment manager now, a running back and defensive back of Maryland's Eastern Shore." Roach journeyed to New York City to play at Columbia University. He left the sport behind after his freshman year and started to run. In a since-archived blog about running, Roach wrote about New York City where he felt like life felt constricting, even choking, the kind of life that makes someone ask the question why nearly every day. Trail running soon became the place to be the most fully himself, and he escaped the constraints of the city for the sanctuary of trees. He placed second at the Wissahickon Trail Classic in 2009. It was all about the trails from there. Of that race, Roach told me he remembers for the first time thinking it was fun, whereas every other harder run I've ever done on roads, I probably wasn't in shape enough to enjoy it. I'd just be like, this is terrible. Then I get stomach pains after, he says. When I got on trails, something about my physiology embraced it, and I liked it. After New York, the hills and rocks and route to North Carolina, where he went to study law after graduating from Columbia University, soon became his best friends. And it was there in North Carolina that he met Megan, his future wife and biggest supporter. He proposed to her with a ring pop. Sports are the coolest places to try out different multitudes, Roach said. In those early years, Roach became someone who could be simultaneously ambitious and joyful. He got good at running and pretty good at being himself. His blog posts from those early years of trail running reveal a side of David Roach not all too different from the David Roach of today. He is sharp and witty and playful. His race reports filled with meandering asides about anything from Achilles tendons to digestive tracts to environmental law. There's a sense of burgeoning joy at the heart of someone who's reveling in the fact of being good, and maybe even really good at something. And Roach was good. He won the United States Track and Field Association 10K Trail Championships in 2012, held at the Continental Trail Divide Trail Race, along with numerous other trail races and sub-ultras. In 2014, he was named United States Track and Field Association's Trail Runner of the Year, all the while he was writing witticisms and meditations and race reports. He was winning and having fun. This kind of multitudinous aspect of Roach's personality is perhaps part of the reason why he's become a polarizing figure in the niche world of ultra running. There are Reddit threads and Let's Run forums populated with users who criticize his training methods, his claims, his coaching style, and more. There are also many devoted fans, but it does seem that many people take issues with his attitude. Relentlessly upbeat positivity that can at times be so relentless that one can't help but question if it is authentic. When viewed from a distance, Roach's persona seems to be this entirely shining, positive, polished thing. But up close, Roach is quick to admit his propensity towards wrongness and failure. He told me how comfortable he has become with the idea of failure and how often he has had the thought that he's not good enough. Throughout my journey, he said, there's been a constant narrative in my own head that you're not the guy. Now 36 years old, over a decade after those early trail races, Roach has decided that he cannot be just the guy, but also someone who models what it looks like to reach for the stars while knowing full well how far away those stars are. I'm just trying to use my short time with this window to hopefully model for people that the mute humility I think a lot of people want to see in their athletes is just fear masquerading as virtue, he told me. And I'd much rather be the virtue of play and joy, and the self-acceptance that comes with that. Because at the end of the day, the chances that I fail at these big goals that I'm saying out loud is probably 99.5%. Roach's belief in himself and in others comes with constant reminders. As Roach talked to me, I noticed a wall hanging above his dining room table that read, "You are enough." Scotch taped to his bathroom mirror is a handwritten sign that reads simply, "Believe." On a run along the Boulder Reservoir, I listened to him offer his trademark encouragement, "You're awesome," to a handful of runners and even someone who seemed to be repairing a telephone pole. These moments of encouragement are reinforced and elevated by Megan. "I'm here to demonstrate what love mixed with being a tough motherfucker looks like," said Roach. "And in Megan, I see the toughest person in the world. Their love is public and loud. It is visible and enormous." While talking with David post-run, I watched Megan walk in and immediately pepper David with questions about his workout. They talked as if I wasn't in the room. It was like watching people speak with exclamation marks hovering above their heads. Her excitement for his run, his excitement for the workout she's about to do. Excitement is a kind of labor. What we work on is also what we love. Their love exudes this intentionality of a training plan. It is a daily progress. The children are part of that love too. Roche's second son, Ollie, is named after the poet Mary Oliver. "Tell me," Mary Oliver writes, "what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" It's a question that is most likely tattooed on the inside of David Rocha's skull. It's a question, too, that holds life's fragility at its heart, which Rocha now knows a lot about. There's another lesser-known Oliver poem, The Journey, which perhaps contains Rocha's answer to Oliver's own question about life. In it, Oliver writes, quote, "But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save." When David Rocha woke up from that headlong collision into a fence, he became determined to save the only life he could save. And saving meant reclaiming the power of his story, which also meant reclaiming the allness of his story. How it contains both joy and ambition, success and failure. That accident seemed to be the catalyst for the current journey of his life, this journey of striding more deeply into the world and his vision of his place in it. And speaking and running with Rocha, I couldn't help but notice that he is someone who is fully starting to embrace who he is, to embrace that new voice he recognizes as his own, which is a voice of complicated multitudinous paradox. He throws out loving encouragement at the same time as he fosters a deep competitive sense of ambition. He happily and publicly declares a wild goal at the same time as he is the first to admit the far-fetched nature of it. He is vulnerable at the same time as he is, in some ways, brazen and full of it. On his living room carpet, I watched him create with his own body a protective cocoon for his youngest child while allowing his oldest child to roll a monster truck off his back and into the air. Some of us harbor a devil on our shoulder, a brutally negative inner voice that tells us we are not enough. But for Rocha, that negativity has been transformed. "There's always a wink in the background of everything that happens," he told me. He was talking about Kurt Vonnegut, one of his favorite authors, someone who believed in kindness and darkness at once. "It is a tragedy," Kurt Vonnegut wrote, "that human beings get so much energy and enthusiasm from hate." Vonnegut begged readers to choose kindness to keep winking through the darkness. This wink is the acknowledgement that there is a bit of mischief and mystery in every story, like a child in the backseat of a car, asking, why, or are we there yet, or did you see that, all over and over again. That child, the one calling shots in the backyard ball game, dancing in their underwear, wondering out loud, is a child that lives in all of us until we stop listening to them or stop hearing them. Last year, David Rocha started listening to that child again, and he hasn't stopped. "Fuck it," that child said, "go for it." So he did. Choosing life after near death, choosing ambition after what he told me was a kind of false humility, choosing confidence after all his insecurity. In her canonical poem, Wild Geese, Mary Oliver writes, "You do not have to be good." Roach would say something similar, that you don't have to be good, but that it's really fun to try, and that it's all right, and maybe even a little entertaining if you fail. When he was talking to me about entropy and impermanence and death, Roach told me, "The only thing that can help other people out is to inject energy into the system. And so, you know, in the face of darkness, you're just trying to bring as much light as possible, even though I'm feeling the darkness in the same way that I think most people are, at least if they think about it deeply enough. And so for me, love is just being like we get one shot at life." Darkness and light, love and sorrow. These paradoxes live in the heart of each of us, and they live, too, in the heart of David Rocha. They live in the landscape of our world, in mountains and valleys, in the snow at the top of Western State's highest climb, and in the rugged desert dirt heat at the race's lowest point. David Rocha is a topographical map of a person, peaks and valleys, all at once. To counter him, then, is to encounter someone who so fully embraces a mindset of both humility, I don't know, and ambition, but fuck, I'll try it. That one cannot help but be drawn in. He is a man in the arena, and whether we like it or not, we have access to it, to the Strava files, the uphill treadmill runs, the hill sprints, the intervals, and the encouragement along the way. I don't know what will happen at Western States this June in Auburn, California. David Rocha is the first person who will tell you he might win. He's also the first person to tell you that he might not. Somehow, he's both of those people at once. That was an article on David Rocha, the Ultra Runner. And next up, we have my Oura, O-U-R-A, ring helps me reduce my stress levels. Rather than distracting me, the accessory helped me tune in. This is by Isabella Ellingson. I first heard about Oura ring over dinner with my girlfriends. We were talking about the link between our high stress levels, sleepless nights, waking up at 2 a.m. randomly, then struggling to fall back asleep, and of course, our social media algorithms bombarding us hourly with self-care content about nervous system regulation, high cortisol, and stress management. Our friend, a physician associate specializing in psychiatry with an integrative approach, mentioned that she had started sleeping better and meditating more after she began wearing an Oura ring. I looked down at the sleek gold ring on her middle finger, seamlessly stacked with her other gold rings. As we all leaned in, intrigued by this little device, a soft green glow radiated against her tan skin. No more 2 a.m. wake-ups or end-of-day fatigue? Say less, goddess. That night, lying in bed, I ordered mine. How does the Oura Ring work? The Oura Ring uses infrared and LED light to track biometrics, including heart rate, and provides daily scores for sleep, activity, and readiness. Its stress tracking feature relies on several of these data points to measure four key states, which it refers to as restored, relaxed, engaged, and stressed, to show how your body responds to life. Within a few weeks, the ring builds a baseline to reveal long-term stress patterns. It includes data from sleep, exercise, and stress response, giving you scores on a 0 to 100 scale in three categories: readiness, sleep, and activity. These scores help you see how well your body is coping and recovering. On average, for example, Oura users experience about 90 minutes in a stress state each day. Not all stress is bad. Hermetic stress or good stress, like cold plunging or exercise, counts towards this number as well. The algorithm then combines all your scores to rate your body's resilience to stress. Resilience is measured as exceptional, strong, solid, adequate, or limited. Like other smart devices, the Oura Ring tracks my steps, heart rate, and exertion. It also measures heart rate variability, which directly reflects how well my nervous system is functioning. Essentially, a higher heart rate variability often indicates that your body is in a more relaxed and balanced state, while a lower heart rate variability could suggest stress or need for recovery. The ring is linked to an app, allowing you to view all associated metrics at a glance on your phone. Remembering to charge another device can be a burden, but I appreciate that the battery replenishes quickly, 20 to 80 minutes on a little ring holder, and lasts me anywhere from 3 to 5 days before I need to recharge. Though the price point, $349 plus a year-long subscription of $70, is admittedly steep, the information, the options for leveraging have proved priceless for me. The good and bad of tracking my stress. Wellness became something of a game for me. How could I use this data to carve out more time for rest, even when my schedule was packed and stress levels were high? I worried the Oura Ring might disconnect me from listening to my body's natural cues, but instead it helped me tune in more deeply. At first, I did feel a bit neurotic. I was constantly checking the app as if someone had revealed analysis that wasn't meant for my eyes, like when you see the doctor taking notes during your appointment and wonder what she might be typing. Was this too much information? Constantly having access to a portrait of my health is something I still struggle with. Another first response, seeing that I was physiologically stressed when I already felt stressed, only stresses me out more. Within a month, my ring collected enough data to accurately depict my stress, and widely, I was spending 3 to 4 hours a day in a stressed state. I was shocked, but when I started to dig a little deeper, it was validating and liberating. If you're like me and my girlfriends, we always try to do it all, and I think I'm finding that while it's possible to do everything I want to do, sometimes I need to slow down before pushing forward. This timeless pursuit is made infinitely easier with the help of my shiny new accessory. As I began to integrate the tool into my life, I began to check the app less frequently and began to view the ring as an ally in understanding my well-being. The data empowered me to understand how I handle stress and guided me to incorporate more mindfulness into my life. 5 ways the Oura Ring helped me live more mindfully. Here are some of the ways the Oura Ring has helped me slow down, increase my restorative time, and improve my meditation, all while managing a full, vibrant, and creative life. 1. I spend more time outside. I've always known how much being out in nature, especially sitting quietly near the sea, calms my nerves. This goal is double for outdoor movement, and it's no wonder surfers get their fix or runners chase that high. I began to notice that even small breaks throughout the day to breathe or move in nature caused my heart rate variability levels to rise over time. Instead of rushing off to Pilates first thing on Monday morning, I started taking walks by the sea or through a park on my lunch break, leaving my phone behind to avoid distractions. The peaceful surroundings became my moving meditation. Having hard data from the Oura Ring to confirm how beneficial this sacred time was validated my decision. Being in a relaxed or restored state at the end of a walk helped my brain see the clear connection between my well-being and time spent in nature. 2, I furthered my unguided meditation practice. Finding stillness and solitude without a guide or group can be difficult. The Oura Ring helped me stay accountable as I started to meditate daily with its unguided session features. I began with just a few minutes of sitting quietly, finding a peaceful corner wherever I was, sometimes in the front seat of my car, with the windows down, or even on the rooftop at work. The more I practiced, the easier it became to meditate for longer periods at a time. Oura tracks your heart rate and heart rate variability and skin temperature during meditation, letting you see how your body has responded once the session is over. I love the little details it gives you as you enter a more relaxed state. Your skin temperature begins to increase. Tuning into the body's signals during meditation helps prove its benefits in real time, and which is highly motivating. It also helps boost my resilience as spending more time in a restored state strengthens my body's ability to handle stressors. 3, data helped me reflect and tune in. My biggest fear about wearing a device all day was that I would begin to disconnect from my body's natural cues. Initially, it was a very cerebral experience, but over time, I started to adjust to knowing so much about my physiological state. After the initial process of integration, real-time data actually enhanced both my intuitive and physical cues. After all, knowledge is power. For example, I noticed that late night meals and any caffeine afternoon were consistently spiking my stress. Armed with this info, I made small changes, such as switching to green tea or avoiding big meals before bed, and saw immediate difference in how I felt. Number 4, I prioritize rest. I used to feel guilty about taking time to do nothing. My friends and I always talk about how there's a fine line between truly restorative rest days, where you're engaged in healthy yet relaxing activities, and the alternative, bed rotting, where you just scroll through social media and snack all day. I'm a firm believer that each has its time and place, but the Oura Ring's focus on restorative sleep and relaxation helped me rethink how I define my downtime. I started creating small rituals to ensure I carved out time for rest, whether that meant taking a nap, journaling, or simply enjoying a quiet cup of tea. The ring tracked my recovery time, showing me that the rest was just as valuable as work in maintaining a healthy balance. These nothing days became essential for recharging, and I stopped seeing rest as a luxury and started treating it as a necessity. Number 5, I'm getting better sleep. The most significant change I noticed was in my sleep. The Oura Ring helped me understand how important it is to shift from a stressed or engaged state to a relaxed one before bedtime. Each morning you can check the app on your phone and see a score out of 100 that rates your sleep quality based on multiple biometrics tracked during the night. I love a late night and definitely still stay out late when it feels right, but I started getting home earlier to wind my sweet body down. The Ring sleep tracking feature revealed that more I allowed my body to enter a relaxed or restored state before bed, the deeper my sleep became and the higher my resilience was to whatever stress came my way. Simple changes such as eating smaller meals with little to no meat earlier in the evening, cutting back on alcohol and caffeine, and lying in bed reading made the biggest difference for my body when trying to enter a restorative state and raise my resilience. Now when my friends and I get together, we nerd out on our sleep scores. The Oura Ring has shown me how to better balance my life. I still experience stress and set a high bar for my productivity, but I'm starting to understand my stress more intimately and have more compassion for what I do to my body and to accomplish what I want in life. I still don't feel great when I see that I have a low resilience score, but I'm getting better at meditating regularly and resting efficiently, which are two ways I can have my own back. Collecting both the data and the tools to be more intentional around this feels pretty revolutionary. And that was how having an Oura Ring helped the author relax. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.